our speeds congealed from swamp water. Nakata breathed quietly, shallowly, but he wasn't afraid. He had a pretty good idea he was face to face with a hostile, aggressive animal. Why this was, he had no idea. But he didn't carry this thought one step further and see himself in imminent peril. The concept of death was beyond his powers of imagination, and pain was something he wasn't aware of until he actually felt it. As an abstract concept, pain didn't mean a thing. The upshot of this was that he was unafraid, even with this monstrous dog staring him down. He was merely puzzled.
"Stand up," the dog said.
Nakata gulped. The dog was talking. Not really talking, since his mouth wasn't moving, but communicating through some means other than speech.
"Stand up and follow me," the dog commanded.
Nakata did as he was told, clambering to his feet. He considered saying hello to the dog, then thought better of it. Even if they were able to converse, he didn't think it would be of much use. Besides, he didn't feel like talking to the dog, much less giving it a name. No amount of effort would turn it into a friend. A thought crossed Nakata's mind. Maybe this dog has some connection with the governor, who'd found out he was getting money for finding cats and was going to take away his subsidy. Wouldn't surprise me at all, he thought, if the governor had this K-9 kind of dog. And if that's what's going on, I'm in big trouble. Once Nakata got to his feet, the dog slowly started to walk away. Nakata shouldered his bag and set off after him. The dog had a short tail and, below its base, two large balls. The dog cut straight across the vacant plot of land and slipped out between the posts of the wooden fence. Nakata followed. The dog never looked back. No doubt he could tell by the sound of his footsteps that Nakata was behind him. As they drew closer to the shopping district, the streets grew more crowded, mostly with housewives out shopping. Eyes fixed straight ahead, the dog walked on, his whole bearing overpowering. When people spied this giant, violent-looking beast, they leapt aside, a couple of cyclists even getting off and crossing over to the other side of the street to avoid facing him. Walking behind this monstrous dog made Nakata feel that people were getting out of his way. Maybe they thought he was walking the dog, minus a lead. And indeed some people shot him reproachful looks. This made him sad. "I'm not doing this because I want to," he wanted to explain to them. "Nakata's being led by this dog," he wanted to say. "Nakata's not a strong person, but a weak one." He followed him quite a distance. They passed a number of crossroads and left the shopping district. The dog ignored traffic signals at pedestrian crossings. The roads weren't so wide, and the cars weren't going fast, so it wasn't all that dangerous to cross on red. The drivers slammed on their brakes when they saw this huge animal in front of them. For his part, the dog bared his fangs, glared at the drivers, and sauntered defiantly across the street. The dog knew full well what the traffic lights meant, Nakata could sense, but was willfully ignoring them. This dog was used to getting his way. Nakata no longer recognized where they were. At one point they passed a residential area in Nakano Ward he was familiar with, but then they turned a corner and he was no longer in familiar territory. Nakata felt anxious. What was he going to do if he got lost and couldn't find his way back? For all he knew, they might not even be in Nakano Ward anymore. He craned his neck, trying to spot familiar landmarks, but no such luck. This was a part of the city he'd never seen before. Unconcerned, the dog continued walking, setting a pace he knew Nakata could keep up with, head up, ears perked, balls swaying like a pendulum.
"Say, is this still Nakano Ward?"
Nakata called out. The dog didn't respond or look round.
"Do you work for the governor?"
Again, no response.
"Nakata's only looking for a lost cat, a small tortoiseshell cat named Goma."
Nothing. This was getting him nowhere, so he gave up. They came to a corner in a residential area with big houses, but no passers-by. The dog boldly strode through an open old-fashioned double gate set into an old-style stone wall surrounding one of the houses. A large car was parked in a carport. Big and black, just like the dog, and shiny. The front door of the house was open. The dog went right inside, without hesitating. Before stepping into the house, Nakata took off his old trainers and set them neatly at the entrance, stuffed his mountain-climbing cap inside his bag, and brushed grass blades off his trousers. The dog stood there, waiting for Nakata to make himself presentable, then went down the polished wooden corridor, leading him to what looked like either a sitting room or library. The room was dark. The sun had almost set, and the heavy curtain at the window facing the garden was drawn. No lights were on. Further back in the room was a large desk, and it looked like someone was sitting beside it. Nakata knew he'd have to wait until his eyes adjusted to say for sure. A black silhouette floated there indistinctly, like a paper cutout. As Nakata entered the room, the silhouette slowly turned. Whoever was there sat in a swivel chair and was turning round to face him. His duty done, the dog came to a halt, plopped down on the floor, and closed his eyes.
"Hello?"
Nakata said to the dark outline. The other person didn't say a thing.
"Sorry to bother you, but my name is Nakata. I'm not an intruder."
No reply.
"This dog told me to follow him, so here I am. Excuse me, but the dog came right into your house, and I followed him in. If you don't mind terribly, I'll be leaving."
"Take a seat on the sofa, if you would," the man said in a soft but strong tone.
"All right, I'll do that,"
Nakata said, lowering himself onto a one-person sofa. Right next to him, the dog was still as a statue.
"Are you the governor?"
"Something like that," the man said from the darkness. "If that makes it easier for you, then go ahead and think that. It doesn't matter to me." The man turned round and tugged at a chain to turn on a floor lamp. A yellow, antiquish light snapped on, faint but sufficient for the room. The man before him was tall, thin, and wearing a black silk hat. He was still seated on the leather swivel chair, his legs crossed in front of him. He had on a form-fitting red coat with long tails, a black waistcoat, and long black boots. His trousers were as white as snow and fitted him perfectly. One hand was raised to the brim of his hat, as if he was tipping it politely to a lady. His left hand gripped a black walking stick by the round gold knob. Looking at the hat, Nakata suddenly thought, "This must be the cat catcher." The man's features weren't as unusual as his clothes. He was somewhere between young and old, handsome and ugly. His eyebrows were sharp and thick, and his cheeks had a healthy glow. His face was astonishingly smooth, no whiskers at all. Below narrowed eyes, a cold smile played at his lips. The kind of face it was hard to remember, especially since it was his unusual clothes that caught the eye. Put another set of clothes on him, and you might not even recognize the man. "You know who I am, I assume?"
"No, sir, I'm afraid I don't," Nakata said.
The man looked a bit let down by this. "Are you sure?"
"Yes, I am. I forgot to mention it, but Nakata isn't very bright."
"You've never seen me before," the man said, rising from the chair to stand sideways to Nakata, a leg raised as if he were walking. "Doesn't ring a bell?"
"No, I'm sorry. I don't recognize you."
"I see. Perhaps you're not a whiskey drinker then," the man said.
"That's right. Nakata doesn't drink or smoke. I'm poor enough to get a subsidy, so I can't afford that."
The man sat back down and crossed his legs. He picked up a glass on the desk and took a sip of whiskey. Ice cubes clinked in the glass. "I hope you won't mind if I indulge."
"No, I don't mind. Please feel free."
"Thank you," the man said, studying Nakata. "So you really don't know who I am?"
"I'm sorry, but I'm afraid I don't."
The man's lips twisted slightly. For a brief moment a cold smile rose like a distorted ripple on the surface of water, vanished, then rose up again. "Anyone who enjoys whiskey would recognize me right away, but never mind. My name is Johnny Walker.
Johnny Walker?
Almost everyone knows who I am. Not to boast, but I'm famous the world over. An iconic figure, you might say. I'm not the real Johnny Walker, mind you. I have nothing to do with the British Distilling Company. I've just borrowed his appearance and name. A person's got to have an appearance and name, don't you think?
Silence descended on the room. Nakata had no idea what the man was talking about, though he did catch the name Johnny Walker.
"Are you a foreigner, Mr. Johnny Walker?"
Johnny Walker inclined his head. "Well, if that helps you understand me, feel free to think so. Or not, because both are true."
Nakata was lost. He might as well be talking with Kawamura the cat.
"So you're a foreigner, but also not a foreigner. Is that what you mean?"
"That is correct." Nakata didn't pursue the point.
"Did you have this dog bring me here, then?"
"I did," Johnny Walker replied simply.
"Which means that maybe you have something you'd like to ask me?"
"It's more that you have something to ask me," Johnny Walker replied, then took another sip of his whiskey. "As I understand it, you've been waiting in that vacant plot of land for several days for me to show up."
"Yes, that's right. I completely forgot. Nakata's not too bright, and I forget things quickly. It's just like you said. I've been waiting for you in that vacant plot of land to ask you about a missing cat."
Johnny Walker tapped his black walking stick smartly against the side of his black boots, and the dry click filled the room. The black dog's ears twitched. "The sun's setting, the tide's going out, so why don't we cut to the chase?" Johnny Walker said. "You wanted to see me because of this cat?"
"Yes, that's correct. Mrs. Koizumi asked Nakata to find her, and I've been looking all over for Goma for the past 10 days or so. Do you know Goma?"
"I know her very well."
"And do you know where she might be?"
"I do indeed."
Lips slightly parted, Nakata stared at the silk hat, then back at his face. Johnny Walker's thin lips were pressed tight in a confident pose.
"Is she nearby?"
Johnny Walker nodded a few times. "Yes, very near." Nakata gazed around the room, but couldn't see any cats. Only the writing desk, the swivel chair the man was sitting on, the sofa he himself was on, 2 more chairs, the floor lamp, a coffee table, and a dog.
"So can I take Goma home?" Nakata asked.
"That all depends on you."
"On Nakata?"
"Correct. It's all up to you," Johnny Walker said, one eyebrow raised slightly. "If you make up your mind to do it, you can take Goma home, and make Mrs. Koizumi and her daughters happy. Or you can never take her back and break their hearts. You wouldn't want to do that, I imagine."
"No, Nakata doesn't want to disappoint them."
"The same with me. I don't want to disappoint them either."
"So what should I do?"
Johnny Walker twirled the walking stick. "I want you to do something for me."
"Is it something that Nakata can do?"
"I never ask the impossible. That's a colossal waste of time, don't you agree?"
Nakata gave it some thought.
"I suppose so."
"Which means that what I'm asking you to do is something you're capable of doing."
Nakata pondered this.
"Yes, I'd say that's true."
"As a rule, there's always counter-evidence for every theory."
"Beg pardon?" Nakata said.
"For every theory, there has to be counter-evidence, otherwise science wouldn't progress," Johnny Walker said, defiantly tapping his stick against his boots. The dog perked up his ears again. "Not at all." Nakata kept quiet. "Truth be told, I've been looking for someone like you for a long time," Johnny Walker said. "But it wasn't easy to find the right person. The other day, though, I saw you talking to a cat, and it hit me. This is the very person I've been looking for. That's why I've had you come all this way. I feel bad about having put you to all the trouble, though."
"No trouble at all. Nakata has plenty of free time."
"I've prepared a couple of theories about you," Johnny Walker said, "and, of course, several pieces of counter-evidence. It's a sort of game, a mental game I play. Every game, though, needs a winner and a loser. In this case, winning and losing involves determining which theory is correct and which isn't. But I don't imagine you understand what I'm talking about. Silently, Nakata shook his head. Johnny Walker tapped his walking stick against his boots twice, a signal for the dog to stand.
15. Oshima climbs into his Miata and flips on the headlights. As he steps on the accelerator, pebbles shoot up, scraping the bottom of the car. He backs up, then turns round to face the road. He raises his hand in farewell, and I do the same. The brake lights are swallowed up in darkness, the sound of the engine fading. Then it's completely gone, the silence of the forest taking over. I go back into the cabin and bolt the door from the inside. As if it was lying in wait for me, silence wraps itself around me tightly once I'm alone. The night air's so cold it's hard to believe it's early summer. But it's too late to light the stove. All I can do is crawl inside my sleeping bag and get some sleep. My mind's a little spacey from lack of sleep, and my muscles ache from bouncing around in the car for so long. I turn down the light on the lamp. The room dims as the shadows that fill the corners grow more intense. It's too much trouble to change out of my clothes, so I crawl into my sleeping bag with my jeans and yachting jacket on. I close my eyes, but I can't fall asleep, my body dying for rest, while my mind's wide awake. A bird occasionally breaks the silence of the night. Other sounds filter in, too, things I can't identify. Something trampling on fallen leaves. Something heavy rustling the branches. The sound of a deep breath. The odd, ominous creak of floorboards on the porch. They sound as if they're right near the cabin, an army of invisible creatures that populates the darkness and has me surrounded. And I feel that somebody's watching me. My skin smarts with the sense of eyes boring in on me. My heart beats out a hollow thump. Several times from inside the sleeping bag, I open my eyes a slit and peer around the dimly lit room, just to be sure no one else is there. The front door's bolted with that heavy bolt, and the thick curtains at the windows are shut tight. So I'm okay, I tell myself. I'm alone in this room, and no one's gazing in at me through the windows. But still, I can't shake the feeling that I'm being watched. My throat's parched and I'm having trouble breathing. I need to drink some water, but if I do, I'll need to take a leak and that means going outside. I'll have to hold on till morning. Curled up in my sleeping bag, I give a small shake of my head. Are you kidding me? You're like some scared little kid, afraid of the silence and the dark. You're not going to wimp out on me now, are you? You always thought you were tough, but when it hits the fan, you look as though you're about to burst into tears. Look at you. I bet you're going to wet your bed. Ignoring him, I close my eyes tight, zip the bag up to just below my nose, and clear my head. I don't open my eyes for anything. Not when I hear an owl hooting. Not when something lands with a thud on the ground outside. Not even when I sense something moving inside the cabin. I'm being tested, I tell myself. Oshima spent a few days alone here too, when he was about my age. He must have been scared out of his wits, same as me. That's what he meant. By solitude comes in different varieties. Oshima knows very well how I feel being here alone at night, because he's gone through the same thing and felt the same emotions. This thought helps me relax a little. I feel I can trace the shadows of the past that linger here and imagine myself as a part of it. I take a deep breath, and I fall asleep before I know it. It's after 6 a.m. when I wake up. The air is filled with a shower of bird calls. The birds flit busily from branch to branch, calling out to each other in piercing chirps. Their message has none of the deep echo and hidden implications of those the night before. When I pull back the curtains, every bit of last night's darkness has disappeared from around the cabin. Everything sparkles in a newborn golden glow. I light the stove, boil some mineral water, and make a cup of chamomile tea, then open a box of crackers and have a few with cheese. After that, I brush my teeth at the sink and wash my face. I pull on a wind cheater over my yachting parka and go outside. The morning light pours down through the tall trees onto the open space in front of the cabin. Sunbeams everywhere, and mist floating like freshly minted souls. The pure, clean air pierces my lungs with each breath. I sit down on a porch step and watch the birds scudding from tree to tree, listening to their calls. Most of them move about in pairs, constantly checking to see where their partner is, screeching out to keep in touch. I follow the sound of the water and find the stream right away close by. Rocks form a kind of pool where the water flows in, swirling around in a maze of eddies before rushing back out to rejoin the stream. The water is clear and beautiful. I scoop some up to drink. It's cold and delicious, and then hold my hands in the current. Back at the cabin, I cook ham and eggs in the frying pan, make some toast using a metal net, and heat milk in a small pan to wash down my meal. After eating, I haul a chair out to the porch, prop my legs up on the railing, and spend the morning reading. Oshima's bookshelf is crammed full of books. Only a few are novels, chiefly classics. Mostly, they're books on philosophy, sociology, history, geography, natural sciences, economics, a huge number of subjects, a random selection of fields. Oshima said he'd hardly attended school at all, so this must have been how he got his education. I pick out a book on the trial of Adolf Eichmann. I have a vague notion of him as a Nazi war criminal, but no special interest in the guy. The book just happens to catch my eye, that's all. I start to read and learn how this totally practical lieutenant colonel in the SS, with his metal-framed glasses and thinning hair, was, soon after the war started, assigned by Nazi headquarters to design a final solution for the Jews. Extermination, that is. And how he investigated the best ways of actually carrying this out. Apparently, it scarcely crossed his mind to question the morality of what he was doing. All he cared about was how best, in the shortest period of time, and for the lowest possible cost, to dispose of the Jews. And we're talking about the 11 million Jews he thought needed to be eliminated in Europe. Eichmann studied how many Jews could be packed into each railway carriage, what percentage would die of natural causes while being transported, the minimum number of people needed to keep this operation going, the cheapest method of disposing of the dead bodies, burning, or burying, or dissolving them. Seated at his desk, Eichmann pored over all these numbers. Once he put it into operation, everything went pretty much according to plan. By the end of the war, some 6 million Jews had been disposed of. Strangely, the guy never felt any remorse. Sitting in court in Tel Aviv, behind bulletproof glass, Eichmann looked like he couldn't for the life of him work out why he was being tried, or why the eyes of the world were upon him. He was just a technician, he insisted, who'd found the most efficient solution to the problem assigned him. Wasn't he doing what any good bureaucrat would do? So why was he being singled out and accused? Sitting in these quiet woods with birds chirping all around me, I read the story of this practical guy. In the back of the book, there's a penciled note Oshima had written. His handwriting's pretty easy to recognize. It's all a question of imagination. Our responsibility begins with the power to imagine. It's just as Yeats said, in dreams begin responsibility. Turn this on its head and you could say that where there's no power to imagine, no responsibility can arise. Just as we see with Eichmann. I try to picture Oshima sitting in this chair, his usual nicely sharpened pencil in hand, thinking back over this book and writing down his impressions. In dreams begin responsibility. The words hit home. I shut the book, lay it on my lap, and think about my own responsibility. I can't help it. My white T-shirt was soaked in fresh blood. I washed the blood away with these hands, so much blood the sink turned red. I imagine I'll be held responsible for all that blood. I try to picture myself being tried in a court, my accusers doggedly attempting to pin the blame on me, angrily pointing fingers and glaring at me. I insist that you can't be held responsible for something you can't remember. I don't have any idea what really took place, I tell them. But they counter with this. It doesn't matter whose dream it started out as. You have the same dream, so you're responsible for whatever happens in the dream. That dream crept inside you, right down the dark corridor of your soul. Just like Adolf Eichmann, caught up, whether he liked it or not, in the twisted dreams of a man named Hitler. I put the book down on the porch, stand up and stretch. I was reading for a long time, and have to get up and move around a little. I take the aluminium pail by the sink and go to the stream to fill it. Next, I take an armload of firewood from the shed out the back and set it by the stove. In a corner of the porch, there's a faded nylon cord for hanging out laundry. I pull out the damp clothes from my backpack, smooth out all the wrinkles, and hang them up to dry. I take everything else out of the pack and lay it out on the bed, then sit down at the desk and fill in my diary for the last few days. I use a pen with a fine tip and write down in small letters everything that's happened to me. I don't know how long I'll remember all the details, so I better get them down as fast as I can. I search my memory. How I lost consciousness and came to in the woods behind a shrine. The darkness. And my blood-soaked shirt. Phoning Sakura. Spending the night at her place. How we talked. How she did that to me. She'd said, "I don't get it. You didn't have to tell me that. Why don't you just go ahead and imagine what you want? You don't need my permission. How can I know what's in your head?" But she got it wrong. What I imagine is, perhaps, very important. For the entire world. That afternoon, I decide to go into the woods. Oshima said that going too far into the forest is dangerous. "Always keep the cabin in sight," he warned me. But I'll probably be here for a few days, and I should know something about this massive wall of a forest that surrounds me. Better to know a little, I reckon, than nothing at all. Empty-handed, I say goodbye to the sunny area and step into the gloomy sea of trees. There's a kind of a rough path trodden down through the forest, mostly following the lie of the land, but improved here and there with a few flat rocks laid down like stepping stones. Places prone to erosion have been neatly buttressed with wooden planks, so that even if the weeds grow over it, you can still follow the path. Maybe Oshima's brother worked on the path little by little each time he stayed here. I follow it into the woods, uphill at first. Then it goes down and skirts round a high boulder before climbing up again. Overall, it's mostly uphill, but not a very tough climb. Tall trees line both sides, with dull-coloured trunks, thick branches growing out every which way, dense leaves overhead. The ground is covered with undergrowth and ferns that have managed to soak up as much of the faint light as they can. In places where the sun doesn't reach, moss has wordlessly covered the rocks. Like someone excitedly relating a story only to find the words petering out, the path gets narrower the further I go, the undergrowth taking over. Beyond a certain point, it's hard to tell if it's really a path or something that just vaguely resembles one. Eventually, it's completely swallowed up in a sea of ferns. Maybe the path does continue up ahead, but I decide to save that exploration for next time. I don't have on the right clothes, and haven't really prepared for that. I come to a halt and turn round. Nothing looks familiar. There's nothing I can cling to. A tangle of tree trunks ominously blocks the view. It's dim, the air filled with a stagnant green, and not a bird to be heard. I'm suddenly covered in goose pimples, but there's nothing to worry about, I tell myself. The path is right over there. As long as I don't lose sight of that, I'll be able to return to the light. Eyes glued to the ground, I carefully retrace my steps, and after much longer than it took me to get here, finally arrive back in front of the cabin. The clearing is filled with bright, early summer sunlight, and the clear call of birds echo as they search for food. Everything's exactly the same as I left it, or at least I think it is. The chair I was sitting on is still on the porch. The book I was reading, face down as I'd left it. Now I know exactly how dangerous the forest can be, and I hope I never forget it. Just as Crow said, the world's filled with things I don't know about. All the plants and trees there, for instance. I'd never imagined that trees could be so weird and unearthly. I mean, the only plants I've ever really seen or touched till now are the city kind, neatly trimmed and cared for bushes and trees. But the ones here, the ones living here, are totally different. They have a physical power. Their breath grazing any humans who might chance by, their gaze zeroing in on the intruder, as though they've spotted their prey, as though they have some dark, prehistoric magical powers. Just as deep-sea creatures rule the ocean depths, in the forest, trees reign supreme. If it wanted to, the forest could reject me, or swallow me up whole. A healthy amount of fear and respect might be a good idea. I go back to the cabin, take my compass from my backpack, and check that the needle's showing north. It might come in handy sometime, so I slip it into my pocket. I go and sit on the porch, gaze at the woods, and listen to Cream and Duke Ellington on my Walkman, songs I'd recorded off a library's collection of CDs. I play Crossroads a couple of times. Music helps calm me down, but I can't listen for very long. There's no electricity here and no way to recharge the batteries. So once my extra batteries are dead, the music's over for good. I work out a bit before dinner. Press-ups, sit-ups, squats, handstands, different kinds of stretching exercises. A routine that keeps you in shape without any machines or equipment. Pretty boring, I'll admit, but you get a decent workout. A trainer at the gym taught me the routine. Prisoners in solitary confinement like this best, he explained, calling it the world's loneliest workout routine. I focus on what I'm doing and go through a couple of sets, my shirt getting sweaty in the process. After cooking and eating a simple meal, I go out on the porch and gaze up at the stars twinkling above, the random scattering of millions of stars. Even in a planetarium you wouldn't find this many. Some of them look really big and distinct, almost as if you could reach out and touch them. The whole thing is breathtaking. Not just beautiful, though. The stars are like the trees in the forest, alive and breathing. And they're watching me. What I've done up till now, what I'm going to do, they know it all. Nothing gets past their watchful eyes. As I sit there, under the shining night sky, again a violent fear takes hold of me. My heart's pounding a mile a minute, and I can barely breathe. All these millions of stars looking down on me, and I've never given them more than a passing thought before. Not only the stars, how many other things haven't I noticed in the world? Things I know nothing about. I suddenly feel helpless, completely powerless. And I know I'll never outrun that awful feeling. Back inside the cabin, I carefully arrange some firewood in the stove, ball up a few sheets of an old newspaper, light it, and make sure the wood catches fire. In grade school, I was sent to camp and learned how to build a fire. I hated camp, but at least one good thing came out of it, I suppose. I open the damper to let the smoke out. It doesn't go well at first, but when a piece of kindling catches, the fire spreads to the other sticks. I shut the door on the stove and scrape a chair over in front of it, set a lamp nearby, and pick up where I'd left off in the book. Once the fire's built up a bit, I set a kettle of water on top to boil, and after a while the kettle burbles pleasantly. Back to Eichmann. Of course, his project didn't always go according to plan. Conditions at various sites slowed things down. When this happened, he acted like a human being, at least a little. He got angry. He grew incensed at these uncertain elements that threw his elegant solution into disarray. Trains ran late. Bureaucratic red tape held things up. People in charge were replaced, and relations with their successors didn't go well. After the collapse of the Russian front, concentration camp guards were sent there to fight. There were heavy snowfalls, power cuts, not enough poison gas to go around. Railway lines were bombed. Eichmann hated the war itself, that element of uncertainty that screwed up his plans. At his trial, he described all this, no emotion showing on his face. His recall was amazing. His life was entirely made up of these details. At 10, I put the book down, brush my teeth and wash my face. The fire bathes the room in an orange glow, and the pleasant warmth calms my tension and fear. I snuggle into my sleeping bag, dressed only in a t-shirt and boxers. Compared to last night, I'm able to shut my eyes easily. Thoughts of Sakura cross my mind. "I was thinking how nice it'd be if I was your real sister," she'd said. None of that tonight. I've got to get some sleep. A log topples over in the stove. An owl hoots outside. And I topple down into an indistinct dream. The next day's the same. Birds wake me up a little after 6. I boil some water, make a cup of tea and have breakfast. Read on the porch, listen to music, go and fill up the water pail at the stream. And I walk down the path into the woods, this time carrying my compass, glancing at it every once in a while to get a general idea of where the cabin is. I found a hatchet in the shed and use it to chop simple hatch marks on trees. I clear out some of the undergrowth as I go to make the path easier to follow. Just like yesterday, the forest is dark and deep, the towering trees forming a thick wall on both sides. Something of the forest is hiding there, in the darkness between the trees, like some 3D painting of an animal, watching my every move. But the fear that made me shudder isn't there anymore. I've made my own rules, and by following them, I won't get lost. At least, I hope not. I come to the place where I stopped yesterday and forge on, stepping into the sea of ferns. After a while, the path re-emerges, and again I'm surrounded by a wall of trees on whose trunks I hack out some markings as I go. Somewhere in the branches above me, a huge bird flaps its wings, but looking up, I can't spot it. My mouth is dry. I walk on for a while and reach a round sort of clearing. Surrounded by tall trees, it looks like the bottom of a gigantic well. Sunlight shoots down through the branches like a spotlight, illuminating the ground at my feet. The place feels special somehow. I sit down in the sunlight and let the faint warmth wash over me, taking out a chocolate bar from my pocket and enjoying the sweet taste. Realizing all over again how important sunlight is to human beings, I appreciate each second of that precious light. The intense loneliness and helplessness I felt under those millions of stars has vanished. As time passes, though, the sun's angle shifts and the light disappears. I stand up and retrace the path back to the cabin. In the afternoon, dark clouds suddenly color the sky a mysterious shade, and it starts raining hard, pounding the roof and windows of the cabin. I strip naked and run outside, washing my face with soap and scrubbing myself all over. It feels wonderful. In my joy, I shut my eyes and shout out meaningless words as the large drops strike me on the cheeks, the eyelids, chest, side, penis, legs and bottom. The stinging pain, like a religious initiation or something. Along with the pain, there's a feeling of closeness, as though for once in my life, the world's treating me fairly. I feel elated, as if all of a sudden I've been set free. I face the sky, hands held wide apart, open my mouth wide, and gulp down the falling rain. Back inside the hut, I dry off with a towel, sit down on the bed, and look at my penis. A light-colored, healthy, youthful penis. The head still stings a little from the rain. For a long while, I stare at this strange organ that, most of the time, has a mind of its own, and thinks thoughts not shared by my brain. I wonder if Oshima, when he was my age and stayed here, struggled with sexual desire. He must have, but I can't picture him taking care of business on his own. He's too detached, too cool for that. I was different from everybody else, he'd said. I don't know what that means, but I'm sure he wasn't just spouting something off the top of his head. He didn't say it to be mysterious and coy, either. I consider tossing off, but think better of it. Being pummeled by the rain so hard made me feel strangely purified, and I want to hold on to that sensation a while longer. I pull on some boxers, take a few deep breaths, and start doing squats. 100 squats later, I do 100 sit-ups. I focus on one muscle group at a time. Once my routine's done, my mind's clear. The rain's stopped, the sun's starting to shine through breaks in the clouds, and the birds have started chirping again. But that calm won't last long, you know. It's like beasts that never tire, tracking you wherever you go. They come out at you deep in the forest. They're tough, relentless, merciless, untiring, and they never give up. You might control yourself now and not masturbate, but they'll get you in the end as a wet dream. You might dream about raping your sister, your mother. It's not something you can control. It's a power beyond you, and all you can do is accept it. You're afraid of imagination, and even more afraid of dreams. Afraid of the responsibility that begins in dreams. But you have to sleep, and dreams are a part of sleep. When you're awake, you can suppress imagination, but you can't suppress dreams. I lie down in bed and listen to Prince on my headphones, concentrating on this strangely unceasing music. The batteries run out in the middle of Little Red Corvette, the music disappearing as though it's been swallowed up by quicksand. I yank off my headphones and listen. Silence, I discover, is something you can actually hear.
16. The black dog stood up and led Nagata out of the study and down the dark corridor to the kitchen, which had only a couple of windows and was dark. Though it was neat and clean, it had an inert feel, like a science lab at school. The dog stopped in front of the doors of a large fridge, turned round and drilled Nagata with a cold look. "Open the left door," he said in a low voice. Nagata knew it wasn't the dog talking, but Johnny Walker speaking to Nagata through him, looking at Nagata through the dog's eyes. Nagata did as he was told. The avocado-green fridge was taller than he was, and when he opened the left door, the thermostat came on with a thump, the motor groaning to life. White vapour, like fog, wafted out. This side of the fridge was a freezer, at a very low setting. Inside was a row of about 20 round, fruit-like objects, neatly arranged. Nothing else. Nagata bent over and looked at them more closely. When the vapour cleared, he saw that it wasn't fruit at all, but the severed heads of cats. Cut-off heads of all colours and sizes, arranged on three shelves like oranges at a fruit stand. The cats' faces were frozen, facing forward. Nagata gulped.
"Take a good look," the dog commanded. "See with your own eyes whether Goma's in there or not."
Nagata did this, examining the cats' heads one by one. He didn't feel afraid, his mind focused on finding the missing little cat. Nagata carefully checked each head, confirming that Goma's wasn't among them. No doubt about it, not a single tortoiseshell among them. The faces of the bodiless cats had strangely vacant expressions, not one of them appearing to have suffered. That, at least, brought Nagata a sigh of relief. A few of the cats had their eyes closed, but most were staring out blankly at a point in space. "I don't see Goma here," Nagata said in a flat tone. He cleared his throat and shut the fridge door.
"Are you absolutely sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure." The dog stood up and led Nakata back to the study. Johnny Walker was still seated in the swivel chair, waiting for him. As Nakata entered, he touched the brim of his silk hat in greeting and smiled pleasantly. Then clapped his hands loudly, twice, and the dog left the room. "I'm the one who cut off all those cats' heads," he said. He lifted his glass of whiskey and took a drink. "I'm collecting them."
"So you're the one who's been catching cats in that vacant plot of land and killing them?"
"That's right. The infamous cat-killer Johnny Walker, at your service."
"Nakata doesn't understand this so well, so do you mind if I ask a question?"
"Be my guest," Johnny Walker said, lifting his glass. "Feel free to ask anything. To save time, though, if you don't mind, I can guess that the first thing you want to know is why I have to kill all these cats, why I'm collecting their heads, am I right?"
"Yes, that's right. That's what Nakata wants to know."
Johnny Walker set his glass down on the desk and looked straight at Nakata. "This is an important secret I wouldn't tell just anybody. For you, Mr. Nakata, I'll make an exception, but I don't want you telling other people. Not that they'd believe you, even if you did." He chuckled. "Listen, I'm not killing cats just for the fun of it. I'm not so disturbed I find it amusing," he went on. "I'm not just some dilettante with time on his hands. It takes a lot of time and effort to gather and kill this many cats. I'm killing them to collect their souls, which I use to create a special kind of flute. And when I blow that flute, it'll let me collect even larger souls. Then I collect larger souls and make an even bigger flute. Perhaps in the end I'll be able to make a flute so large it'll rival the universe. But first come the cats. Gathering their souls is the starting point of the whole project. There's an essential order you have to follow in everything. It's a way of showing respect, following everything in the correct order. It's what you need to do when you're dealing with other souls. It's not pineapples and melons I'm working with here, agreed?"
"Yes,"
Nakata replied, but actually he had no idea.
A flute? Was he talking about a flute you held sideways? Or maybe a recorder? What sort of sound would it make? And what did he mean by cats' souls?
All of this exceeded his limited powers of comprehension. But Nakata did understand one thing. He had to find Goma and get her out of here. "What you want to do is take Goma home," Johnny Walker said, as though reading Nakata's mind.
"That's right. Nakata wants to take Goma to her home."
"That's your mission," Johnny Walker said. "We all follow our mission in life. That's natural. Now, I imagine you've never heard a flute made out of cat souls, have you?"
"No, I haven't."
"Of course you haven't. You can't hear it with your ears."
"It's a flute you can't hear?"
"Correct. I can hear it, of course," Johnny Walker said. "If I couldn't hear it, none of this would work. Ordinary people, though, can't detect it. Even if they do, they don't realize it. They may have heard it in the past, but don't remember. A very strange flute, for sure. But maybe, just maybe, you might be able to hear it, Mr. Nakata. If I had a flute on me right now, we could try it, but I'm afraid I don't." Then, as if recalling something, he pointed one finger straight up. "Actually, I was about to cut off the heads of the cats I've rounded up. Harvest time. I've got all the cats that can be caught in that vacant plot of land, and it's time to move on. The cat you're looking for, Goma, is among them. Of course, if I cut her head off, you wouldn't be able to take her home to the Koizumis, now, would you?"
"That's right," Nakata said.
He couldn't take Goma's cut-off head to the Koizumis. If those two little girls saw that, they might give up eating forever. "I want to cut off Goma's head, but you don't want that to happen. Our two missions, our two interests, conflict. That happens a lot in the world. So I'll tell you what, we'll negotiate. What I mean is, if you do something for me, I'll return the favor and give you Goma safe and sound." Nakata lifted a hand above his head and vigorously rubbed his salt-and-pepper hair, his habitual pose when puzzling over something.
"Is it something I can do?"
"I thought we'd already settled that," Johnny Walker said with a wry smile.
Yes, we did, Nakata said, remembering. That's correct. We did settle that already. Pardon me.
We don't have a lot of time, so let me jump to the conclusion, if you don't mind. What you can do for me is kill me. Take my life, in other words.
Hand resting on the top of his head, Nakata stared at Johnny Walker for a long time.
You want Nakata to kill you?
That's right, Johnny Walker said. Truthfully, I'm sick and tired of this life. I've lived a long, long time. I don't even remember how old I am, and I don't feel like living any longer. I'm sick and tired of killing cats, but as long as I live, that's what I have to do, murder one cat after another and harvest their souls. Getting things in the correct order, step one to step ten, then back to one again, an endless repetition, and I've had it. Nobody respects what I'm doing, it doesn't make anybody happy, but the thing's fixed. I can't suddenly say, I quit and stop what I'm doing. And taking my own life isn't an option. That's already been decided, too. There are all sorts of rules involved. If I want to die, I have to get somebody else to kill me. That's where you come in. I want you to fear me, to hate me with a passion, and then eliminate me. First you fear me, then you hate me, and finally you kill me.
But why? Why ask me? Nakata's never ever killed anyone before. It's not the kind of thing I'm any good at.
I know. You've never killed anyone and don't want to. But listen to me. There are times in life when those kinds of excuses don't cut it anymore. Situations when nobody cares whether you're suited for the task at hand or not. I need you to understand that. For instance, it happens in war. Do you know what war is?
Yes, I do. There was a big war going on when Nakata was born. I heard about it.
When a war starts, people are forced to become soldiers. They carry guns and go to the front lines and have to kill soldiers on the other side, as many as they possibly can. Nobody cares whether you like killing other people or not. It's just something you have to do. Otherwise, you're the one who gets killed.
Johnny Walker pointed his index finger at Nakata's chest.
Bang, he said. Human history in a nutshell.
Is the governor going to make Nakata a soldier and order me to kill people?
Yes, that's what the governor will do, tell you to kill somebody.
Nakata thought about this, but couldn't quite understand. Why in the world would the governor do that?
You've got to look at it this way, that this is war. You're a soldier and you have to make a decision. Either I kill the cats or you kill me, one or the other. You need to make a choice right here and now. This might seem an outrageous choice, but consider this. Most choices we make in life are equally outrageous.
Johnny Walker lightly touched his silk hat as if making sure it was still in place.
The one saving grace for you here, if indeed you need such a thing, is the fact that I want to die. I've asked you to kill me, so you don't need to suffer any pangs of conscience. You're doing exactly what I'm hoping for. It's not as if you're killing somebody who doesn't want to die. In fact, you're doing a good deed.
Nakata wiped away the beads of sweat that had formed on his hairline.
But there's no way Nakata can do something like that. Even if you tell me to kill you, I don't know how to go about it.
I hear you, Johnny Walker said admiringly. You've never killed anybody before, so you don't know how to go about it. All right, then, let me explain. The knack to killing someone, Mr. Nakata, is not to hesitate. Focus your prejudice and execute it swiftly. That's the ticket when it comes to killing. I have an excellent example right here. It's not a person, but it might help you get the picture.
Johnny Walker stood up and picked up a large leather case from the shadows below the desk. He placed it on the chair where he'd been sitting and opened it, whistling a cheery tune. As if performing a magic trick, he extracted a cat from out of the case. Nakata had never seen this cat before, a grey-striped male that had just reached adulthood. The cat was limp, but its eyes were open. It looked conscious, though barely. Still whistling his merry tune, Hey-Ho, from Disney's Snow White, the one the Seven Dwarfs sang, Johnny Walker held up the cat as if he was showing off a fish he'd just caught.
I've got 5 cats inside this case, all from that vacant plot of land. A fresh batch, just picked fresh from the grove, so to speak. I've given them all injections to paralyze them.
It's not an anaesthetic. They're not asleep, and they can feel pain, but they can't move their arms or legs, or even their heads. I do this to keep them from thrashing about. What I'm going to do is slice open their chests with a knife, extract their still-beating hearts, and cut their heads off. Right in front of your eyes, there'll be lots of blood and unimaginable pain. Imagine how much it'd hurt if someone cut open your chest and pulled out your heart. Same thing holds true for cats. It's got to hurt. I feel sorry for the poor little things. I'm not some cold, cruel sadist, but there's nothing I can do about it. There has to be pain. That's the rule. Rules everywhere you look here. He winked at Nakata. A job's a job. Got to accomplish your mission. I'm going to dispose of one cat after another, and finish off Goma last. So you still have a little time to decide what you should do. Remember now, it's either I kill the cats, or you kill me. There's no other choice. Johnny Walker placed the limp cat on the desk, opened a drawer, and with both hands extracted a large black package. He unwrapped it and spread the contents on the desk. These included a small electric saw, scalpels of various sizes, and a very large knife, all of them gleaming as if they'd just been sharpened. Johnny Walker lovingly checked each and every blade as he lined them up on the desk. Next, he got several metal trays from another drawer and arranged them, too, on the desk. Then he took a large black plastic bag from a drawer, all the while whistling hey-ho. "As I mentioned, Mr. Nakata, in everything there's a proper order," Johnny Walker said. "You can't look too far ahead. Do that, and you'll lose sight of what you're doing and stumble. I'm not saying you should focus solely on the details right in front of you, mind you. You've got to look ahead a bit, or else you'll bump into something. You've got to conform to the proper order and at the same time keep an eye out for what's ahead. That's critical, no matter what you're doing." Johnny Walker narrowed his eyes and gently stroked the cat's head. He ran the tip of his index finger up and down the cat's belly, then picked up a scalpel in his right hand and without any warning made an incision straight down the stomach. It all happened in an instant. The belly split wide open and reddish guts spilled out. The cat tried to scream, but he barely made any sound. His tongue, after all, was numb, and he could hardly open his mouth. But his eyes were contorted in terrible pain, and Nakata could well imagine how awful this pain was. A moment later, blood gushed out, wetting Johnny Walker's hands and running down his waistcoat. But he didn't pay attention. Still to the accompaniment of hey-ho, he thrust his hand inside the cat's body, and with a small scalpel skillfully cut loose the tiny heart. He placed the gory lump on his palm and held it out for Nakata to see. "Take a peek. It's still beating." Then, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, he popped the heart into his mouth and began silently to chew, leisurely savouring the taste. His eyes glistened like those of a child enjoying a pastry hot from the oven. He wiped the blood from his mouth with the back of his hand and carefully licked his lips clean. "Fresh and warm, and still beating in my mouth." Nakata stared at the scene before him without a word. He couldn't look away. The smell of fresh blood filled the room. Still whistling his jolly tune, Johnny Walker sawed off the cat's head. The teeth of the saw crunched through the bone and severed it. He seemed to know exactly what he was doing. The neck bone wasn't very thick, so the operation was quickly finished. The sound, though, had a strange weight to it. Johnny Walker lovingly placed the severed head on the metal tray. As if relishing a work of art, he narrowed his eyes and gazed intently at it. He stopped whistling for a second, extracted something stuck between his teeth with a fingernail, popped it into his mouth and carefully tasted it, then smacked his lips, satisfied, and gulped it down. Next, he opened the black plastic bag and casually tossed in the dead cat's body like some useless shell. "One down," Johnny Walker said, spreading his bloody hands in front of Nakata. "A bit of work, don't you think? You can enjoy a nice fresh heart, but look how bloody you get. No, this my hand will rather the multitudinous seas incarnadine, making the green one red." A line from Macbeth. This isn't as bad as Macbeth, but you wouldn't believe the dry cleaning bills. This is a special outfit, after all. I should wear a surgical gown and gloves, but I can't. Another rule, I'm afraid. Nakata didn't say a word, though something was beginning to stir in his mind. The room smelled of blood,
and strains of hey-ho rang in his ears. Johnny Walker pulled out the next cat from his bag, a white female, not so young, with the tip of her tail bent a little. As before, he stroked the cat's head for a while, then leisurely traced an invisible line